It's Friday, January 10, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The issue of abortion leads our consideration today, and the most important development on that front has not occurred in the United States this week, but rather in Israel, where that nation's government has adopted one of the most liberal abortion laws ever known to humanity, putting Israel amongst the handful of the most liberal nations in the world on the issue of abortion. As was reported in the Israel Times, the Israeli government has now adopted a policy that will not only make abortion legal in almost any circumstance, but will also make it government funding, guaranteeing a free abortion to all women between the ages of 20 and 33. As Deborah Kamin reports for the Times of Israel, Israel, a nation with a forceful religious lobby and a conservative prime minister, is poised to offer its female citizens some of the most liberal abortion coverage in the world. She reports that the Health Ministry Commission, headed by Dr. Yonatan Halevi, has announced what it calls its health basket, that is, the package of medication, services, and other programs that all Israeli citizens are now to have. And the focus of the biggest concern has to do with the issue of abortion. That policy was approved by the Israeli cabinet this past Sunday. The health basket, which is analyzed and amended on an annual basis, she says, will now offer abortion to Israelis free of charge for women between the ages of 20 and 33. She goes on to explain, and I quote, "Israel has always had a liberal stance on abortion, allowing women facing medical emergencies or those who are victims of rape or abuse to receive subsidies to help them terminate their pregnancies. Outside of those regulations, women can apply for abortions for reasons ranging from an emotional or mental threat caused by the pregnancy or for not being married to the baby's father. All women," she says, "who seek to end a pregnancy must appear before a three-person committee in order to make their case," but she also reports that 98% of requests are approved. Women under the age of 20 or over the age of 40 are also previously eligible for subsidized abortion, regardless of the reason. So in other words, previously, if you were under 20 or over 40, you already had access to a subsidized abortion in Israel. But now if you're between the ages of 20 and 33, that abortion is not only subsidized with partial coverage of the cost, but it is fully funded by the Israeli government. This is where the story grows even more ominous. Kamin reports, with the newly amended health care package, funding will now be available for more than 6,000 additional women seeking to terminate their pregnancies. And of course, the cost is listed. And that's an estimated $4.6 million American dollars in increased cost. She then offers these words, quote, "No medical reason for the abortion is required," end quote. Dr. Halevi, the head of the Health Ministry Commission, then offers this absurd sentence, quote, "We want large families in Israel. We definitely encourage birth. But when pregnancy occurs and it is undesired or inadvertent, I think we should supply the means to end the pregnancy properly," end quote. Well, let's consider that sentence for just a moment. Dr. Halevi says, "We want large families in Israel." Let's remember that Israel has put a priority on large families from its Jewish citizens from the very beginning of the experience of Israel as a new nation. The encouragement of large families has been central to Israel's project of building itself as a nation, the only Jewish nation and the only democracy in the entire Middle East. But he goes on to say, when pregnancy occurs, after saying we encourage birth, and it is, the two words he uses are undesired or inadvertent. Two very interesting words to choose when talking about a pregnancy. In moral terms, these are not only very weak words, they are words that seem to resound in an ominous way when you think about the experience of the Jewish people in the 20th century. He then follows those two words, undesired or inadvertent, with the words, "I think we should supply the means to end the pregnancy properly." In other words, ending the pregnancy properly means killing the unborn child. The Times of Israel then reports, quote, "The number of nations that now take a stance as liberal as Israel's on abortion can be counted on one hand. In Canada, abortion is legal at any stage of a woman's pregnancy, and those performed in hospitals, but not in private clinics, are for the most part covered by insurance. In Slovenia, abortion has been free since 1977, and in 2006, a government minister who tried to limit funding to only those women whose lives were at risk was promptly asked to resign his post," end quote. The paper then goes on to make this observation. While Israel may seem an unlikely party to such liberalism, global legislation on abortion proves that when it comes to the life of a fetus, a nation's politics do not always jive with its attitude towards the controversial procedure, end quote. I want to suggest that that sentence is unsustainable. Israel is a democracy. Its government is democratically elected. The government, as a democratic government, democratically elected, does indeed reflect the views of the people who elected it. And to make that point even more emphatically, there are two statements in this article to that very effect. For one thing, the newspaper reports that response to the new policy has been, quote, surprisingly muted. The doctor who announced the policy at the very end of it said, "I didn't hear much opposition." American Christians rightly have a very special place for Israel in our hearts. We think of Israel not only as the only democracy in the Middle East, but as a providential vessel for the preservation of the Jewish people. And we understand that Israel, even geographical Israel, has a continuing place in terms of salvation history. But when it comes to the government of Israel, we must keep very much in mind that Israel, in this sense, is a very secular nation. Not only does it have an overwhelmingly secular government, secularization in terms of the worldview of the Israeli people has become so widespread that you can have a policy like this now adopted by the Israeli parliament without much opposition, with the response to it surprisingly muted. In other words, this is a policy that fits the Israeli culture and the Israeli people at this time. It is now reflected in the official action of the Israeli government. This is one of the saddest developments to occur in a very long time. But as this news article makes very clear, there is a history to this development, and this latest announcement by the Health Ministry Commission is just the next step in Israel's progressive slide into its current status as among the handful of nations with the most liberal abortion laws on earth. As we think about the biblical allusion to Rachel weeping for her children, we can only weep for the unborn children of Israel, now very much an increased threat by this new policy. Meanwhile, here in the United States, abortion continues to be a front burner issue. In an article published in recent days in the New York Times, Eric Eckholm reports what we already know, and that is that abortion is headed as an issue into several federal courts, especially appellate courts, as the issue of several restrictive laws passed by the states on abortion now heads for judicial action. And several of these have already been decided at the district level, with other decisions pending at the appellate level and likely action by the Supreme Court eventually, if not this year, then very soon. But the year 2014 is shaping up to be a very pivotal year, the year yet before us. Eckholm cites Suzanne Goldberg, director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law at Columbia University, who said, quote, "I think we are at a potential turning point. Either access to abortion will be dramatically restricted in the coming year, or perhaps the pushback will begin." Meanwhile, on the other side of the issue, Carol Tobias, president of National Right to Life, said in the same story, quote, "I'm very encouraged. We've been gaining ground in recent years with laws that are a stronger challenge to Roe. I think it is more difficult to get an abortion in the country today," end quote. She is undoubtedly right, pointing to the 20-plus restrictions passed in recent months by the respective states. Back about 100 years ago, the New York Times actually built its circulation into the modern newspaper that it is by crusading against abortion. But in yesterday's edition of that very paper, an editorial ran entitled "Abortion Restrictions in Texas and Beyond." The conclusion of that editorial includes these words, quote, "The Texas law is part of the surge of anti-abortion measures in the guise of health and safety protections or based on a scientifically dubious theory of fetal pain approved in Republican-controlled states over the past 3 years. In 2013 alone, 22 states adopted 70 different restrictions," the Guttmacher Institute reports, "including pre-viability abortion bans that defy Supreme Court precedent, unwarranted doctor and clinic regulations, limits on medication abortion by forbidding use of the most up-to-date drug protocol, and bans on insurance coverage. These restrictions," says the paper, "make it more difficult for women in many regions to obtain an abortion," end quote. In other words, at that point, the editors of the paper agree with Ms. Tobias that abortion is more difficult to get in at least some states. The editorial then ends with these words, "To stand a chance of rolling back these restrictions, supporters of abortion rights will need to fight harder and more nimbly than ever on three fronts, in the courts, in the legislatures, and at the ballot box," end quote. At that point, we simply have to observe that those who are determined to stand for the sanctity of life, the life of the unborn in this case, must be fought on these three fronts, the courts, the legislatures, and at the ballot box. But to that we would add a fourth, the most important of all, and that is the court of public opinion. For whether the public is that of Israel or the United States, at the end of the day, the court of public opinion is where this battle will be, humanly speaking, won or lost. And on that count, we have much work to do. Today's edition of the Wall Street Journal includes a very important opinion piece by Johnny Erickson Tata, the very well-known and widely respected evangelical speaker, author, and artist. Johnny Erickson Tata, you'll recall, is a quadriplegic after an accident and has lived for decades now as a quadriplegic and as a very eloquent advocate for those with disabilities, and in particular, for the sanctity of life of those who suffer very serious disabilities. In her opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal today, entitled The Disability Double Standard, Johnny Erickson Tata argues that in the 23 years since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, she has watched its most celebrated ideals crumble under a double standard. She then writes, apparently, when it comes to people with disabilities having a right to live the fullest life possible, some disabilities are more deserving than others. She writes that the ADA, or the Americans with Disabilities Act, was originally passed in order to get past the mentality that it was to correct, and that is, that those with disabilities are better off dead than disabled. Now she says, however, that is being undermined by developments such as pushes for assisted suicide and a focus on a quality of life that insinuates, if not insists, that those who have very severe disabilities cannot achieve a quality of life that most persons would consider to be acceptable. And once assisted suicide and euthanasia are promoted as options or even allowed as options, the logic of removing those with disabilities becomes very, very clear. And very, very threatening. She makes specific reference to a ruling that took place in Washington State where a couple was awarded on December the 13th of last year $50 million in a landmark case known as a wrongful birth lawsuit. After the couple's son was born with very severe disabilities, the couple argued that the hospital and the laboratory did not fulfill their responsibility, their medical responsibility, in screening for a particular and very rare genetic abnormality. Mrs. Tata then writes this, quote, "The ruling nevertheless sends a clear message that a person with a disability may not have a life worth living. It inevitably will put more pressure on healthcare professionals and insurance companies to test for every possible fetal abnormality, thus putting more lives at risk in the womb. So while a disabled person's civil rights are recognized under federal law, those rights are nullified when confronted with stereotypical notions about the tragedy," she puts the word tragedy in quotes, "of a disabled person's existence," end quote. She then looks at the nation of Belgium, which we have discussed in recent weeks, as contemplating legalizing the euthanasia of children. By the way, that nation has now gone beyond merely contemplating the possibility and is actively pushing forward with that legislation. Johnny Erickson Tata then points to the double standard inherent in the fact that Belgium has signed the 2009 United Nations Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, a statement that includes these words, quote, "Every human being has the inherent right to life and shall take all necessary measures to ensure its effective enjoyment by persons with disabilities on an equal basis with others," end quote. She then says, "I don't understand how the Belgian legislators can agree that individuals with disabilities have the inherent right to life, yet at the same time offer a so-called right to die, not only to adults, but also, heartbreakingly, to children who may feel distraught by their condition," end quote. She then suggests that the United States and its government itself is complicit in this double standard in several ways. More recently, the American Medical Association classified obesity as a disability. Will the federal government also recognize the same? Are those with obesity now to be listed among the disabled? And will their disability be considered something that could render them having something less than an acceptable quality of life? She ends her very eloquent essay with these words, quote, "What kind of society do we want? If we are seeking a good society, then we do well to defend the rights of the helpless, not nullify their rights in order to destroy them. It benefits all of us to minister to those who are hurting, not to agree with them that life isn't worth living," end quote. Her article, once again, appears in today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. But a prophetic foresight of her article appeared in the previous day's edition of the Palm Beach Post in Florida. That paper had a front page article on Thursday indicating that a father who had won a $2.5 million wrongful birth suit against a doctor for the birth of his son with very severe disabilities has now had that suit overturned by an appellate court and now must go back to court seeking once again to prove the case of a wrongful birth. But the article is truly haunting. It is indeed horrifying. One central issue in the legal case has to do with Florida's law on abortion, a law that, following the pattern set by Roe v. Wade back in 1973, outlaws abortion in the third trimester. One crucial legal issue in this case is the actual trimester the child was in when, in his unborn state, it was discovered that the child had very severe disabilities. The medical doctor in the hospital ruled that the child was in the third trimester and thus no abortion was possible. Once the baby was born, it was not, as the parents claimed, the, quote, perfect baby, end quote, they had been promised. It was instead a child with very severe disabilities. They won a wrongful birth suit, and it is now going back to the courts, as we have said, after that decision was reversed on appeal. The issue of abortion is integral to this case. It is at the very center of it, because the parents, in making their case before the jury, argued that if they had known that the baby had such a disability and there was a possibility of an abortion, they would have aborted the baby. In the words of the article, the couple would never have brought the baby into the world. They would have opted for an abortion. Christians must recognize the quality of life argument for what it is. It is the enemy of the sanctity of life argument. We are all concerned about the quality of life, and we understand a moral obligation to try to help every single human being to have the highest quality of life possible. But we also understand that in a fallen world, illness, disability, injury, and any number of other issues can complicate that quality of life. We also understand, and we must sympathize with, people who are struggling against grave disabilities and other difficulties, whose disabilities and difficulties cannot be overcome with current medical technology or with any other human means. Recall that Johnny Erickson Tata, writing that article for the Wall Street Journal, is writing from the credibility of having been a quadriplegic now for a number of decades. She is uniquely qualified by that experience to speak as an authority to this issue. The quality of life argument subverts the sanctity of life by suggesting that there is somehow a continuum, a gradation in terms of the value of life. This is the very kind of logic that led to the German medical experiments and to the Holocaust. Lebens und Wertensleben was the argument used by the doctors of the Weimar Republic in Germany, even before the Nazis came to power and were able to use the argument. Lebens und Wertensleben is life unworthy of life. And the assumption that there could be something such as life unworthy of life is not only injurious to the value of every single human life, it is not only an insult to the image of God in which every single human being is made, it is also a very direct and present threat to human life and human dignity. The very fact that so many people around us have adopted a quality of life argument is a sign of just how much work remains to be done to defend the sanctity of human life. And on this Friday, with so many other issues worthy of our consideration, it's hard to believe that any issues can transcend these in terms of importance. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Palm Beach Gardens, Florida. And on Sunday, I'll be preaching the morning services at the First Baptist Church of Pompano Beach. I hope perhaps to see some of you there. In any event, I'll meet you on Monday for The Briefing.